Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. It is Monday, November 2nd. I think I might start saying the date on all of the episodes. I don't know. Give it a try. This week, I am excited to have the chance to sit down with ex-Seventh-day Adventist minister. I guess it's a minister, maybe a pastor. Maybe those words are interchangeable. I'm not sure. Ex-Seventh-day Adventist pastor, perhaps, Ryan Bell, who after spending a year without God as an experiment, has continued to spend his life without God. And I think we can all learn quite a bit from him. But before we jump into the interview, I just want to thank a handful of people who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Over at Patreon, which you can access by going to www.patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to thank Timothy Glover of McCordsville, Indiana. I want to thank Phil Tiber of Pointe Claire, Quebec. And I want to thank Elena Scott, a new contributor from Los Angeles, California. And thank you to everyone else. I think right now it's something like 75 contributors for keeping Talk Nerdy 100% free to download. I also want to thank those of you who have popped into the PayPal portal, which you can access by visiting carasantamaria.com and showing your support for the podcast that way. There's a lot of ways you can show your support. You can visit carasantamaria.com and click on the store link, or maybe it's the shop link. I don't even know. But there you'll see all sorts of cool Talk Nerdy swag. Not been selling a lot lately. I'll tell you what. Not many people have visited the store. I know I have one listener who has reached out and said, make beanies. And I'd love to make beanies, but I can't make beanies if people aren't buying t-shirts, unfortunately, because I usually have to pay for this stuff up front. But it's fun. It's cool. There's, you know, some nice stuff there. So, I don't know. Check it out. Maybe I'll put a new coupon code up next week for you just to entice you a little bit more. And by the way, it is store. I just looked it up. Also, I want to apologize for not having a new episode last week. The reason for that is that I have been working like a crazy person and was recently co-hosting a special on National Geographic called Brain Surgery Live with Mental Floss. That was actually last Sunday. And so it was just too crazy with the flights and with all of the work to be able to get a new episode posted in time. But, you know, 1 week off, many, many weeks to come. So I just want to thank you for coming back week after week and, you know, for making this a labor of love between all of us. Also, guys, probably the best way that you can support the show is to tell your friends, tell your family, tell the people at work, tweet about it, Facebook about it, and maybe even go onto iTunes or Stitcher and rate and review and subscribe. That's a huge, huge help. All right. Enough of that. Let's move on to the show this week. So again, I want to thank or welcome or thank and welcome Ryan Bell. He is an ex-Seventh-day Adventist minister who spent a year without God as an experiment, and now he's continuing that year. Here he is, Ryan Bell. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's good to be here.
So are you Pastor Ryan?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. No. So you don't keep the title after you've left.
No.
Even though you legally can officiate like weddings and funerals and things.
Well, I can because I'm also ordained in the Church of Bacon.
Gotcha. So in the Church of Bacon, are you Pastor Ryan? Are you Minister
yeah,
Ryan?
Yeah, actually they dubbed me Prophet of Defrocked Pastors.
Oh, I like that.
Isn't
okay,
that good?
So Prophet Ryan.
Yeah. So if you need to be any predictions, let me know.
I love it. I love it. Yes, prophecies are important.
Too bad it's
and they're
not
almost
a call-in.
Always correct.
Yeah, exactly. They're almost always correct. And if
it
was a call-in show, we could just be
oh my God, I don't know.
giving people their answers today.
So speaking of, you know, I'm joking about this, but the reason that I ask you if you're Pastor Ryan is because you used to be Pastor Ryan.
I did.
In the Seventh-day Adventist Church, are they pastors?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a lot I don't know about Seventh-day Adventists. So when I was in grad school, there's a woman in my lab who I actually became very good friends with. She herself was a Seventh-day Adventist getting a PhD in neuroscience. She rejected evolution. It was a huge thorn in everybody in the lab side. My professor would give her so much shit for it. And she just had her, you know, her dogma that she would kind of talk her. And then eventually he would get so frustrated that he'd be like, stop talking or I'm not going to graduate you. All I know is that I think of it as like biblical Christianity, like Old Testament Christianity. There's some kind of Judaism type things like no eating shellfish and... That's right. Like in there, right?
It is, because the Adventists, which sort of the proto-Adventists came around in the mid-1800s, they had a kind of restorationist bent. And there were a few restorationist groups, which simply meant that they were trying to restore the pure faith mm-hmm. of the apostles, you know, going back and trying to figure out how do we weed out all the human influences in religion and get back to the biblical faith. Of course, forgetting that the Bible is a human document.
So it's basically the exact opposite of legitimate, like, anthropology.
Right. So basically, yeah, the idea is, well, the Old Testament, I mean, a lot of new Christians say, well, the New Testament superseded mm-hmm. the Old Testament, but Adventists can't get away with that because it's the whole Bible. How can you say one part is gone?
Yeah.
But then
they don't even acknowledge the New Testament, do they?
No. Mm-mm.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Yeah, for them, the inspiration stopped at the end of the prophets, you know, so when the last prophet was killed before the sort of that Maccabean period.
And then all of those apostles and all of their stories are basically just stories.
Yeah, they're just stories. I mean, Paul was an apostate.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, an apostate Jew.
An apostate. Apostle.
Yeah, something like that.
An apostle. Apostle. Yeah.
Well, you know, Ben Carson's a Seventh-day Adventist.
Yes, and also a brain surgeon. Which
and
is
also,
why,
again.
I did this brain surgery live thing on Nat Geo, and like, you know, it was funny the first time, but like after the 15th tweet, like, is it Ben Carson doing the surgery? Yeah.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, God. So does that make you, obviously, I shouldn't put words in your mouth. Maybe, obviously, Ben Carson doesn't make you nervous as a candidate.
Oh,
for...
he makes me plenty nervous, yes.
But does the added layer of being a Seventh-day Adventist make you nervous?
I mean, it does in a way. Like, I don't think that anybody is going to become president and immediately enforce their religion. I mean, mm-hmm. the Congress wouldn't allow it. People, I mean, Mitt Romney, we all wondered the same thing mm-hmm. a few years ago. And I just don't think the president can unilaterally do any of that kind of stuff. I mean, Obama's had a hard enough time implementing his political agenda. So,
yeah.
So I don't think that it's dangerous in that, in that very specific sense, but it definitely influences things. Like, he doesn't believe in, I mean, as ironic as it is, as you were saying, he's a brain surgeon, but he doesn't believe in so many other aspects of scientific consensus.
Yeah. He may not believe in evolution.
Correct. Well,
which
he doesn't.
Like, how do you have a brain without evolution?
There's a recording that was just resurfaced. Of course, when you run for president, all that shit comes mm-hmm. back to the surface. You don't have any privacy anymore. And a lecture that he gave to a church group came back to the surface, in which he said something along the lines that evolution, that Darwin developed the theory of evolution under the influence of Satan.
Oh, my God.
Right?
So the brain just is what it is because God touched Adam or something and he had a brain.
Well, yeah. I mean, according to the biblical story, human beings were created as basically we are now. And in fact, if you were to say, how have we changed? A conservative Adventist would say we've only become less complex. In other words, Adam was way more superior to us.
Oh, gotcha. Because he was like a pure form. And
right.
then like the environment has actually damaged us and we've become less godlike.
Correct.
Because their explanation of why God looks a whole hell of a lot like a person is that we were made in his image, not the other way around.
Not the other way around.
Which I think most free thinkers would agree that God was made in man's image, obviously.
Correct.
He was
yeah.
an invention of man. And woman. I'm going to blame men for this one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this way,
mostly dudes that
I
were
think you can blame
then.
The men for yeah. this one. Yeah, they pretty much invented God to keep the women in line, probably.
Probably.
Among
oh, yeah,
others.
There's a big reason. Yeah, the women, the minorities, the poor people.
Anybody they don't like.
Anybody they want to control, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
get money from and all of that good stuff. But the reason, of course, for people who maybe didn't read the description of the podcast or for people who don't know your work, the reason we're talking about you know, I'm asking you as an expert on Seventh-day Adventism, and the reason I'm asking you about whether or not you are still pastor is because you were not just a Seventh-day Adventist, but like in it.
Yeah. No, I was a pastor. I was, in fact, my church was very close to where we are right mm-hmm. now. It was just up here in Hollywood on the Hollywood Boulevard exit ramp from the 101 freeway. So,
oh, wait. Do I know?
It's kind of a lavender-colored, 60s-looking
building. So it's not
building.
The big white one that actually is pretty liberal and is always has things signs on no, the no, thing about, like...
No, that's the United Methodist Church.
Yay, gay marriage and that kind
right.
of stuff.
Right, yeah.
No, that
that's
wasn't
the
yet.
One where they sell Hollywood Bowl parking
yeah.
on the weekends and stuff like that.
And they seem pretty hip.
They are. I know the minister there, and they're very progressive. I mean, the church is declining because the percentage of believers in the United States is declining. Mm. But... you know, as churches go, they're doing a decent amount of good in the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the churches that are going to maintain membership are the churches that are willing to willing to kind of keep up with the times, you know, because people are like, wait a minute, my cousin's gay and right. I don't think he's a monster. Like, they're starting to rethink a lot of the dogma that doesn't seem to apply to the modern era.
Right.
And so you see these more Methodist, I think you see some of these like non-denominational churches that are like, yeah, we can... be hip with it. You even see some like Catholic and Episcopalian churches that are sort of hip.
Right. I think market share is a powerful motivation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you see your percentage of the market declining, you think, well, maybe we can make room for some other people in here. And then that's where theology and theologians come in handy, because then you have people that say, oh, we've been interpreting these passages wrong all along. And with a real interpretation allows for gays and lesbians to be.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? So there's a whole line of theological work that is geared around explaining how we've been wrong all along. And now we understand it.
Now let's broaden our horizon. Yeah, I mean, I think the Mormon church is a good example of that, too. I was raised in the Mormon church. I never became, you know, ordained because I couldn't, because I'm a chick.
You got the wrong biology.
Right,
sorry
right.
About
so,
that.
But I left at 14. And when I went to church, there were a few black people. But I'm pretty sure that in the 70s, there weren't none.
Right.
You know, and then all of a sudden, yeah, I think maybe we were thinking about this the wrong way.
They had a whole doctrine about that.
Uh-huh.
Right?
About like the mark of Cain, and there was all this crazy shit. I mean, it was so fucking racist. And then
overtly.
And then all of a sudden it was like, maybe this is, you know, how are you going to do missionary work in Africa if you can't convert black people? It's just insane. So I think that even these very conservative religions do have their ways to go like, oh, how do we get membership up? How do we make more money? Maybe we should expand the pool of admissions here. And so sometimes they're doing it for the right reasons. Sometimes they're doing it for the wrong reasons. But either way, as you said, it's declining. And you are an example of one of those people who was in the flock, who is in many ways leading the flock.
Right.
And then skedaddled.
Right. So I was, you know, I think by all estimations, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is very conservative, doesn't accept gays and lesbians as... legitimate, I guess. I mean, they've sort of evolved to the point where they've said, well, if you are gay or lesbian, you're acceptable as long as you're celibate, you know, that type of thing.
Oh, that's a bummer. So
right.
It's more like my dad was giving me the whole spiel because somebody in my family came out and he was giving me the whole spiel. And it was basically the hate the sin, not the sinner.
Right.
You know, like the act is an abomination, but we still love the people that we love. Is it kind of similar to
right,
that?
Right, because back to science for a second, like the science has revealed that, you know, sexual orientation is something that isn't a choice. It's something that you just are.
Yeah, and also, I hate to break it to you, it's pretty fluid.
Yeah, right? It moves all over the
We're
place.
We're kind of not all just straight or gay.
Right.
There's a whole lot of in between.
Yeah. So, you know, I think once that was generally accepted, then people said, well, I mean, we can't ostracize you because you have blonde hair.
Yeah, like
you
can't change. We're not going to make you dye it brown. Although there is still a push. I mean, so Seventh-day Adventists don't promote conversion therapy. They just kind of...
Well, they have.
Oof, yeah.
And it's not as popular anymore, but there is still some of that.
Well, yeah, because it's like been denounced by the American Psychological Association as being like damaging psychologically to people. So,
yeah.
But that's true. You always are going to push... sort of a radical treatment or a radical approach to trying to keep the dogma intact until enough of the culture pushes back. Again, with the Mormons, polygamy was normal practice until it became against the law. And because they respect the law of the land so much, that's when they stopped committing quote unquote polygamy, except for the fundamentalists. But the main church said, okay, we now are not okay with this anymore.
And do you ever remember, I was just talking to someone about this very thing the other day. Do you remember there being a theological explanation, or did it sort of just slowly fade into the woodwork?
Well, I think it's one of those things where all of us who are alive today were born long after this was against the law. So when we think of church history, or the way that we're taught church history in this insulated way within the church, is that at the time, you know, we were going west, we were pioneers, a lot of men were dying in the war, and we needed a way to be able to perpetuate and to be able to. And so, and you see this a lot. I mean, culturally, you see it a lot, where polygamy is a way to keep a lot of families reproducing when there aren't enough men.
Right.
And so, but they're very clear about the fact that, like, until, you know, it was ordained by God, whatever the fuck, like God told us to do it. And then once it was denounced by the federal government, and because it's a very nationalistic religion,
right?
Like the leader of the country is in many ways not equivalent to the leader of the church, but demands almost as much respect.
Right.
So, so they definitely are very patriotic in that way. So when the federal government says this is now the way that things are, they say, okay,
yeah,
we're not going to break the law.
Right.
Which is why then you have all these weird FLDS sects of like crazy people living on compounds who are like, we disagree.
Well, and the Mormon church has a sitting prophet at all times too. So you can always get a new revelation from God.
Oh yeah. That's the whole trick of prophecy, right? It's like a dude goes into the woods, and now it's even more official. It's like, I don't know, he's sitting at his desk.
Right.
I don't know how he does it now. It's like he like calls him on the red phone or something, because it's very like professional.
Yeah. God sends him an email. Exactly. It's like, look, I'm really busy, don't have time for that conference call today, but here's a little memo.
So true. But before it was like, oh, I went into the woods. And like, what a legit position, right? You're like, oh, so God talked to me. Just me. No one else. So I'm pretty sure I'm the conduit.
Prove that I didn't talk
exactly.
to God.
Exactly. And so like, pretty sure you should follow me and I'll get all of the accolades.
Well, the Adventist Church has a prophet. I mean, we don't have the church doesn't claim to have an active prophet.
Gotcha.
But our prophet, you know, passed away in 1915.
And so it's kind of like there was only one ever.
There was only one.
So
right.
It's like your Muhammad.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, or like Joseph Smith, if there were no further...
If Brigham Young didn't happen. And
right, exactly. Yeah. And actually, Adventism emerges in America almost around the same time as Mormonism.
So it's also a really new religion.
It's very new.
And a specifically American religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's just...
From New England.
But you don't say the second coming of Jesus is going to happen in Missouri, so you don't get all the jokes.
No, and we didn't dig up any plates in the backyard or any of that kind of stuff. So yeah, that it's very biblical. And then Ellen White's writings, in fact, our prophet was a woman, which seems pretty progressive.
Yeah.
Even though the Adventist Church still refuses to recognize women's ordination in the church ministry.
So
the
wait,
same
how
way
do they
men.
Explain that to kids?
They just don't. I mean, basically the Bible, I guess what they try to say is that Ellen White was a special case. In fact, she was not a pastor. She was a prophet. And so her prophetic ministry is not necessarily an excuse or a reason why we would have. Although the church has plenty of female pastors, they just have a second class ordination.
I see. So that's, in some ways, that is more progressive than see how we're turning this into a Seventh-day Adventist versus Mormon conversation?
Yeah.
Then no, Mormon women cannot hold the priesthood. Mormon women literally have no power in the church. They're secondary completely. I remember when my sister got married, they had broken some rules in the church, so they couldn't get married in the temple. And so they had an actual church wedding where the bishop actually married them. And so I got to see it. You know, you hardly ever get to see Mormon weddings because they're in the temple. And you
only
have to,
Mormons can go
in. Yeah. Well, not just Mormons. You have to be a fancy pants Mormon who already has all these ordinations just to
wow.
get in. So you probably already have to be married. You have to have gone through a lot of these temple recommends and things like that. But I remember like losing my shit because it was that standard thing of like, do you, man, agree to honor God and honor Jesus in every way, blah, blah, blah. I do. Do you, woman, agree to honor your husband, blah, blah. It's always this thing. And I remember talking to my dad and being like, what the fuck? But not in those terms. And he was kind of like trying to argue that through transitive properties that somehow serving your husband is the same as it was.
The husband is the go-between, like Jesus, between us and God.
Yeah. Fucked up. Totally fucked up.
Totally.
So it's like they try to make it so that, well, women can feel the spirit. They can get the gift of the Holy Ghost, which is a weird Mormon thing. But it's like everybody has like a feel the spirit situation in their religion. But like bros have like a better connection with the deity.
Right.
And so you're a bro and you had like the pinnacle connection with your deity. Right.
I guess. I mean, I never, you know, I was always sort of a Badventist. You know, I was never...
But not so bad that you didn't decide to become a minister.
Right. That's true. So when I was very fundamentalist in college, fundamentalist.
You must have been so not fun.
I was so not fun. Really not fun.
So what'd you study in college?
I studied pastoral ministry and theology.
Oh, so yeah.
Well, here's the kicker, and you'll appreciate this. I started my college career because I towards the beginning of the AP curriculum in high schools, I was in high school way back when, and I was I had my course in AP English and AP Physics. So I was sort of torn between, and calculus. So I was torn between the liberal arts and the sciences.
And a lot of people are made to think, especially back then, it's getting better, but to think that there's a hard dichotomy.
You got to choose one.
It's got to be one or the other because you can't be both because nobody has those kinds of skills.
Right. So I chose, when I went to college, to an Adventist college, I was a double major in math and astrophysics.
That's
and
amazing.
I wanted to be an astronaut, and I knew that I, because of my religious convictions as well as my temperament, I'm just not a fighter, I was no way I was going to be a military pilot and get into space as a pilot.
And those are pretty much the two tracks, right?
Science or military.
Yeah, like Air Force.
Right.
And so, wait a minute. I just want to be clear on this. So you went to an Adventist college here in LA?
No, it's in the Napa Valley.
Okay. Isn't there one that's around here? Or
not?
No?
Well, there's one in La Sierra in the Inland Empire. So it's like Riverside and Loma Linda.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Loma Linda. Yeah, that's
what the big Adventist hub in Southern California.
Gotcha. Yeah. So that's
big
what
medical
I was thinking.
School.
And they have a big medical. So this is the thing. They have a physics department. You can train to be an astrophysicist. They have a big medical school.
Right.
Yet they don't believe in things like evolution.
Well, what's really interesting, and I just experienced this because I was invited by a psychology professor at my alma mater, Pacific Union College, to come and give a colloquium lecture to the psych and social work students about my experience and the social construction of reality, the narrative construction of our worldviews, and how those things shape us and hold us and then sometimes fall apart and leave us, you know, sort of bereft. And he had invited me. He was a one-year professor, like he had only been a professor for 1 year, my freshman year in 1989.
Oh, so that's how you knew him.
And I knew him from then on. He's been in that role. Obviously, he's moved up, but he's been teaching psychology for 25 plus years in that role. And he invited me to come back, and I'm sort of a celebrity ex-Adventist, which is a very small pool. You're like a proper celebrity. I'm like,
I'm like a
celebrity ex-Adventist. So like, there's nobody that they vilify more than me right now. So,
oh, you're the target.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and there's not even a cool name for it, by the way. Like, former Mormons get to be Foremans.
Foremans, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what's a former Adventist? I guess it's ex-Adventists.
Ex-Adventists, yeah. So it's like ex-Adventists. And so the president of the university got wind of my lecture, and she uninvited me.
Oh, shit.
So it was supposed to be today. Remember I told you my Thursday completely opened up? I was supposed to be up there right now giving this lecture. And why was I telling you that? Oh, because I think each individual discipline teaches their discipline. So he teaches psychology. He teaches the history of psychology, including Freud and Jung and all the modern notions about psychology, which have a lot of anti-religious overtones, right?
But there are also some really pseudoscientific overtones in psychology, which I struggled with because that was my major. But I think that which psychology I think is a good example, but I'm trying to think of, okay, so you're at a medical school. Let's say you go to Loma Linda and you're an undergrad and you decide you want to be pre-med, or a lot of pre-med students get biology or chemistry degrees. Like that's a good in for medical school. How the fuck do you teach or learn biology with a strong religious basis? Like,
see,
it's nearly impossible.
You see that Adventists tend to be doctors, dentists, nurses, other medical allied health professions. Mm-hmm. And and this goes back to Ben Carson. So how could someone as truly gifted as Ben Carson have so many ridiculous ideas, political and otherwise? And what I've sort of come to the conclusion is that the medical sciences are very narrow.
They're practical sciences.
They're technical experts.
Yes.
So Ben Carson is narrowly brilliant, you know, but he's not broadly. And this is what we were talking about before, about the division between the liberal arts and the sciences and philosophy. I you don't see very many people today that are broadly. This is why people love Christopher Hitchens so much, because he could speak intelligently across a wide range of topics.
That's true. And also, like, the medical fields in many ways aren't, you know, you meet somebody who has an MD and you you might, in the back of your mind, assume that they're scientifically knowledgeable, but you can actually sort of get away with basically getting an applied degree.
Yeah.
Where, let's say that we're talking about MRSA, right? A bacterial infection, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, where it's resistant to the kind of penicillin staph or the methicillin class of drugs. And the reason for that is because of evolution. Like, that's well documented,
right?
That these pathogens, these bacterium, have evolved because of our antibiotic usage to have this resistant property. But you can actually diagnose MRSA, you can give a treatment for MRSA, and you don't have to acknowledge how MRSA came to pass. You just have to know how to approach it from a health and wellness perspective.
That's right.
So I think that's a good example of how some people can get away with what I think of as having these two contradictory mindsets.
I think if you were a researcher and you were trying to develop a new treatment for MRSA, and you had to do the research, you know, you're sort of backwards engineering this, and you realize, okay, evolution, this is how
it... Yeah, how do you not realize? But that's why I thought it was so crazy that my colleague in a research lab where we were studying neuroscience, she was getting a PhD, was so firm in her faith, because there were like massive gaps in her knowledge where you would be like, you can't have those two thoughts in your head at the same time.
Except that you can.
And feel comfortable.
This
but
is the thing, this compartmentalization that we're capable of is just really phenomenal.
And it makes me wonder if there is a background tension, or if we're just so good at ignoring the tension, or really honestly not recognizing that it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And we're okay with kind of having these two things and just saying, well, God works in mysterious ways.
Right. I think I was just going to say that. I think when I was a pastor, and I'm not a scientist, and I was not really I was not trained in the sciences. In fact, I'm reading Richard Dawkins' The Blind Watchmaker right now, and I'm so embarrassed, and your listeners are going to make fun of me. It's literally the first book I've ever read about evolution.
And by the way, that's a tough one.
It's actually really enjoyable. I like it a lot.
I'm glad, because they're definitely, I think, better like starter books.
Probably,
you kind of jumped into the deep end, but that's good.
Yeah. So I mean, I know what the average layperson knows about evolution. I'm not completely ignorant of evolution.
Yeah, but there are nuances in evolution that you don't really you don't really get a feel for until, like, what are the driving forces, and you know, until you actually start to study it.
Or the specific examples, like, you know, he'll bring up this thing about bees or this thing about ants or whatever, and those are great examples. And so I'm really bad in a Facebook debate with a knowledgeable creationist.
Oh, me too. I'm terrible at it, because I am not knowledgeable about creationism.
Right.
You know what I mean? This is why I think debating, I talk about this a lot with David Smalley, actually. He actually invited me one time, hey, do you want to be involved in a debate? And I was like, I will never debate somebody, because I'm not a debater. Like,
another narrow expertise.
It's such an expertise. Like, it does not matter how much expertise you have in your field. If you don't know how to debate
someone else's ideas,
if you don't know how to twist their, you know, all that shit, it's theater, and I don't know how to do it.
I've even watched some of the greats, you know, be slightly stumped, because even like there was a debate, I can't remember who, it was like William Lane Craig was debating Chris Hitchens or something like that. And there was this thing that, and Craig is a brilliant debater, he says this thing, and the look on Hitchens' face is sort of like, wait, what did you just say? And he doesn't have a quick comeback, because he hasn't thought of that absurdity.
Exactly. How do you respond to something if it's literally the first time you've ever heard it? If you can't fact check it live.
Right.
And so now you're having to flex a cognitive muscle to break down this argument. But the argument, like you said, is absurd.
Yeah. And it's kind of a gotcha type of kind of art.
Because then the audience goes like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, he just got him. Yeah. And people are like keeping score at home. Like, he landed a good, you know, uppercut.
And that's kind of the whole, I think, a famous example of a debate that probably many, many just general people watched was Bill Nye and Ken Ham.
Right.
And I don't know how, you know, obviously the people who are like the science people and who are big fans of Bill Nye are like, Bill Nye owned it. But like, did he?
Especially,
or is Ken Ham really good at what he does?
Yeah. And I think if you're on the Ken Ham side, you probably think Ken Ham owned it. You know? And they're talking literally past each other.
I know. Yeah. They're not actually debating. It's just like, I make a point. Now you make a point. Now.
Right.
And in the end, I mean, there were some things, and this is kind of besides the point, that ultimately I'm not sure what a great idea it was, because ultimately Kemhan did come out the financial winner of that debate,
right,
and was able to fund a lot of things that are antithetical to Bill Nye's ethics,
yeah,
using the money he made through the debate, which is rough.
Yeah, my friend Dan Errol has been keeping track of Ken Ham since then and has outed him a few times about the tax money that he's tried to get to build his ARC experience. So
is Dan the guy with the big Buddy Holly glasses? I feel like I see him on Facebook sometimes.
No, I don't know that he
does. Does his Facebook picture have like big black?
I don't think so.
Damn it. I feel like I know who you're talking about.
His blog is called Danthropology.
And he looks Dan, kind of like rockabilly. I could be wrong.
Yeah, he maybe has that. He's got a lot of tats and stuff like that. He's cool.
Sorry, random. but you know what's funny is that at this point, we have been talking almost for half the time, and we haven't even talked about your story. We've given a lot of preface. You were a Seventh-day Adventist pastor, and I want to get a timeline now. You went to a Seventh-day Adventist university, so at this point you're probably normal university age, 18, 19.
Right.
You're studying theology?
Well, I started off in sciences and math.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, so that's an interesting place to start. So I started off in math and physics, and I was so bored by my chem lab, my chem 101 lab.
It was that just, makes me so sad.
Because it was just predictable experiments. Like, I knew what the outcome was. Like, mix this with this and see what
color.
Yeah,
and obviously you didn't have the benefit of having a teacher who's really inspired by the science and
right,
who could pass that on. Yeah, which
and
so
honestly,
makes
I was
sad.
Like a typical 18-year-old. My friends were going, you know, out to A&W to get a hamburger, and I'm in the lab.
I love it, though. That's not typical. Like,
no.
That's like a typical, like, super Christy 18-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
I like how they were going out for a burger and a root beer.
Exactly. They were going out for a burger and a root beer. And exactly. And we had to go down the hill for that. That was a high price we paid for that.
No mind-altering substances for
you
guys.
No. I was straight arrow. So I kind of got bored with it, and I thought, maybe I'm too much of a people person. So I went to my other expertise in high school, which was English.
Mm-hmm.
So I start off in English, and my required freshman great books class, one of the selections is Candide by Voltaire, which Ellen White, the prophetess that we were mentioning a moment ago, specifically names Voltaire as an infidel author who we should not read as Christians.
Which is so weird because you're at a Seventh-day Adventist college.
And they're requiring this book.
Wow.
And as a fundamentalist myself, I challenged the teacher at my Adventist college and said, look, I can't read this.
And you're a fundamentalist at this point because you always have been?
Well,
you were raised in it?
Yeah. I mean, I was raised by very conservative grandparents for the most part. But they were not, like, if you met them, you wouldn't think, ooh, scary fundamentalists. They're just like normal people, but very conservative, very literal in their understanding of the Bible. And then I just had this fundamentalist turn when I went to college, you know, and I like to tell people, like, I really straightened up my act when I went to college. I, like, burned all of my bootleg cassette tapes of the Beatles and threw away, you know, my bootleg recordings of The Cure and these various...
And can you point to what it was, that switch in your mind that made you think, like, gosh, I haven't been living a proper life and I really need to clean up?
I think my aunt and uncle were alumni of the same college, and my grandparents reinforced to me that when you go there, just because it's a Christian school doesn't mean everybody's behaving as a Christian. You can find whoever you want. And so I kind of had this in my head, like, there are people that are taking their faith seriously and there are people that are just up there fucking around. And so I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take my faith really seriously. I really felt internally, I felt drawn into that. And I'm writing about that right now.
And also, this is the first time that you're like, you're a man, you're on your own, you're mortally responsible for the decisions that you make. You can no longer just rely on these role models in your life. You have to kind of prove that you're the guy who's doing the right thing.
And I think I was a little bit of a nerd. Like, I wasn't so, and that was before nerds were cool. Like, you know, I was undersized for my age, I think, for men, young men my age. And
you likely weren't getting laid.
No.
But you wouldn't want to get laid.
I wasn't even thinking. I mean, that's how funny it was. It was just, I hadn't even, I mean, I had. Big revelation.
Like, I thought about it, but you suppressed those thoughts?
No. Well, I mean, I had had sex in high school.
You did?
Yeah,
so
but I was just racked with guilt.
Oh.
And that was another thing. I was like, nope, I'm breaking up with broke up with my girlfriend. I was like, I'm going down the straight and narrow.
Oh, poor girl.
I know. You're well, right. You know, it was meant to. I mean, it wasn't destined for greatness. But
still.
She
turned you astray. You probably blamed her so much.
Yeah, maybe so. I just thought, I'm just a bad bad person.
But isn't that such a gross, like, dude thing, like a patriarchal dude thing to do in religion, where it's like all the girl's fault for like having tits?
Right.
It's like she's having tits and she's not completely covering to her neck. So like, because men can't control themselves.
No.
It's totally the woman's fault.
Animals.
Anyway.
So from there, I went to English, but I couldn't read the books. So I was like, well, this isn't going to work out. So then I went to history and I thought, well, that's fairly safe.
You know? You like dropped that class because you didn't want to read the book.
I dropped the class. In fact, she gave me an independent study where she tried to disabuse me of this fundamentalist notion, but it didn't work. I held my guns. And I just corresponded with her as recently as this last week, because she's now the academic dean. And it was her that I heard from to disinvite me. She's a wonderful lady. She was just doing her job. But I spoke to her on the phone like literally 2 days ago, the same lady.
That is so weird. And she was like really nice about it, but basically this is not in line with the ethics of the university.
Yeah, we just can't have it. It's just not going to work out. It's a PR. I mean, she was very honest. It's a PR nightmare to have me up there and all of that.
Do you think she's a Seventh-day Adventist?
Oh, she is.
Oh, she is.
Oh, yeah, she is.
Do you think she like legit believes in it all?
No, I mean, not all of it. I mean, she's part of a liberal wing of the Adventist church that's sort of like, well, I mean, there is a liberal wing that believes evolution the way you do and I do.
How can they not? Because it, just like in the Mormon faith, it's very, in many ways, it sounds like it's very pro-science.
It is.
And so what you end up doing is like, you've got a certain percentage of the sect that actually like, you know, really study science, and they can't get through that kind of a training.
Right.
Without being like, I kind of, you know, Darwin had some good ideas.
Right. So. Exactly. I mean, it's just... Yeah, it's just there to look at, and you're like, what do I do with this information? So I went to history, and then from there I landed in pastoral ministry, and when I decided I wanted to be a pastor, I transferred to an even more conservative college.
And at this stage, what are you, like still a freshman, a junior, a sophomore?
I was a junior at that point. I had taken some time off and gone to the Philippines as a missionary, a student missionary, sort of like the Mormons. It's not required in Adventism. But
how long was that?
I was there about 9 months.
Okay, yeah. So at this point you're maybe like 21.
I was like 21.
Yeah, okay.
And then I graduated from this very conservative Bible college as a pastoral ministry, and got hired in Pennsylvania. And at the age of 22, I start pastoring 3 churches.
I always forget that in most religion, because it's not like this in the Mormon faith, like that you get a paycheck for being a pastor.
Yeah, there's professional clergy.
That it's a job.
Right.
Yeah, in the
for
Mormon faith, it's not like
Mormons,
that at all.
Really.
Yeah, they're the ones who, they get like what do you call it? Like the priesthood is like endowed upon them, and they get the prayers and everything. And then it's kind of a volunteer thing. They like take turns.
Right.
And even the actual church service is community members.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's the congregation coming up and sharing stories and stuff. There's not like a pastor.
It's
in the
really
Mormon
a remarkable, just from a business perspective, it's remarkable that the Mormon church has become so successful spreading their message around the world with no paid clergy.
That's true.
It'd be like saying, like, we're going to take McDonald's and we're going to spread McDonald's brand all over the world, but we're not going to pay anyone.
Yeah, but we're going to make it so, like, it's like, I shouldn't say this on air. It's kind of, I'm not going to name names. There are some media companies that are like that, where it's like, but it's so cool to work for us.
Right.
That
you should be so lucky.
Exactly. So they pay everybody shit because everybody's like, yeah,
well,
but like, I get to work
that
with
way.
That brand. Yeah, exactly. So it can work. And I think they were smart to do it from the beginning. Because who does get paid? Like the missionaries, they don't make money, but obviously they don't have to pay to go on a mission.
Well, that's sort of like the Catholic vow of poverty for the priesthood. You know, they take a vow of poverty, but they're taken care of. The promise, the exchange... So in a way, the priests are married to the church.
Yeah, but I think even that's like more legit. Like I honor that more than
because
in the Mormon church, they're all like capitalist fucks. Like everybody's super rich,
right?
Or kind of poor.
One or the other.
Yeah, there's like a dichotomy there because it's also promoted in the church to be like a good businessman and blah blah blah.
Right.
Of course, I keep saying man, and that's because the men are the ones who are paid attention to.
Who run the thing?
I digress. So at this point, you go to Pennsylvania.
I went to Pennsylvania. I was there for about 5 years, and then I went to seminary to do my master's degree and in Michigan. And then I finished my master's degree in 2000.
Okay.
I was about 30, 29.
And this is, what's your master's degree in? It's from seminary. But
Master
what?
Of Divinity.
Divinity.
It's a sort of a, I'm a master of divinity.
That's
I still am. They
really
can't
cool.
take that away. So, yeah.
And do you have like all sorts of cool robes when you graduate?
You know, because the Adventist church is so non-liturgical that we don't have any robes. That's Catholic. We're against that.
Oh, weird. So when you walked, when you got your master's degree.
Yeah.
That's what I was
graduation
thinking.
Robe. I mean,
that was just like my master's degree. It's like
robe.
You wore the same thing.
Yeah. And then I have a doctorate from Fuller Theological Seminary.
So you kept going.
So I kept going.
Is it a PhD? Is it a doctorate of
philosophy? No, it's a doctor of ministry. It's a professional doctorate.
So it's a DM?
D-min.
D-min. That's what it would say on your business card?
Yeah. Well, I never put it on my business card because it felt pretentious. And a little pretend.
But also, that's funny that pastors have business cards.
Right?
It's just weird. Like with a big cross.
Right, exactly. Yeah. If you ever need to get a hold of God, you can reach out to me.
So, wow. Okay. So you are, at this point, legit, I've been saying that a lot, legit, like, God trained. Right. Like, you know all the stuff.
I have a terminal degree in God.
Yes. And you also are obviously command a lot of respect. Like, at this point, anybody who is Seventh-day Adventist, they're just a member of the congregation. Mm-hmm. They see that you have all of this training from these Adventist universities. So not only are you academically trained, but you're also very kind of spiritually trained, mm-hmm. because you've been giving yourself to God in this way.
Right. And I think all along that journey, too, I'm becoming more liberal.
Interesting. Because I think that happens as you increase your education.
Yeah. In fact, I remember hearing when I was in high school or in college, like, don't go to seminary to get your master's degree in divinity from our approved Seventh-day Adventist seminary, because you'll lose your faith. So many pastors go to seminary and lose their faith.
And so, it's because they're like, you have to learn about other faiths, or?
I mean, just because you learn where the Bible comes from, for one thing. Like, you learn, like, you do textual analysis.
It's so funny that there's an insight that people have. Mm-hmm. If you go to university, you're going to lose your faith. If you, the more you learn, the less you're going to have. And it's like, let's break that down a little and try and figure out why. Like, how is it that you can say that with a straight face,
right,
but then not make the second leap, which is that maybe there's a reason people are losing
their
faith?
Well, we're taught to distrust our human rationality and our human ability to know things that revelation, mm-hmm. from God through the Bible for us, mostly as Seventh-day Adventists, and through the prophet, but mostly through the Bible, because our prophet has to comport with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not in the Bible, like, in other words, the Bible stands in judgment over all other knowledge. Whereas,
gotcha.
You know, other, like, modern rationality would say, no, any book, any claim to knowledge is subject to all other claims to knowledge. And we have to sort these things out and put them into dialogue with each other and say, well, if this disagrees with this, we have to decide which one's right.
But basically, you have to look at the Bible as the arbiter of all of that.
Right.
So as soon as you start to say, yeah, but this is a really good explanation for all this, I keep going back to evolution, but evolution is a good example, because every field, geology, paleontology, microbiology, you know, there's all these fields that like have kind of concurrently confirmed evolution.
Right.
But for example, if it doesn't hold biblical muster, then it's probably, in their view, not a legitimate explanation.
Right. And I think creation science, in as far as we can put those two words together,
yeah,
in a phrase.
Yeah, he did air quotes, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, I mean, the effort to achieve a kind of creation science is really a scientific effort to make the data comport with the biblical story. So,
which unfortunately is, in and of itself, like, anti-science.
Right, because you've started with your conclusion.
Exactly. But it is an attempt to do it in a way that masquerades, I think, as science. Or to the people that are actually attempting it, they don't see it as a masquerade. They see it as a, well, we've got to reconcile this somehow.
They have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so the effort to do, or you just ignore it, which is what I did. I said, well, I kind of think evolution's probably true because all these really smart people seem to think so. Which I think is the position most people are in, because we can't all go get a PhD in biology.
Exactly. So, but they're like, but I'm not an expert, so...
What do I know?
Should I listen to my pastor, or should I listen to my doctor?
Right. And my thing was, so if I had given a sermon saying basically Darwin was right and we've evolved in this way, I would, my job would have been in jeopardy.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
I was able to do, though, was to say Genesis 1 is a certain kind of creation story. Genesis 2 is a completely different kind of creation story. Neither one is actually an attempt to describe in scientific terms how we came to be.
Mm-hmm.
The whoever wrote those chapters, those words, didn't even think in scientific terms. It was a pre-scientific.
Science wasn't
a like thing
invented yet.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Like, so they were basically telling competing stories against the other competing stories of other cultures, and it was a political maneuver.
So it is the case that the more educated many pastors become, the more they're able to describe biblical happenstance as a historical phenomenon.
A historical phenomenon. Okay. Yeah. And I think the effort, I mean, a lot of people that I would talk to that still believe in a God or still even practice their faith would say, like, there's this God that they believe in, and all religion is a faulty attempt to try to make some sense of it.
So, but this is interesting because as you're continuing on in your education, your training, and then your career, basically, you're becoming more liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But just like you were saying, you know, that is a perfect example, the description that you just had, of a more progressive, more liberal, academically religious person.
Right.
But now you're sitting here before me and you're not religious.
No.
And so that becomes the question. At what point do you lose the concept of God, not just the concept of all of the dogma and the lore around God, but the actual concept of God in your mind? And this kind of goes to your year without God.
Right.
Am I skipping ahead?
No, it's fine. I mean, I was sort of brought up on charges of being too liberal and not Adventist enough. And so I was expelled from my position. I was forced to resign from my position here in Hollywood.
Was there something specific at the time that you had done?
It was a mosaic of issues. It was, LGBT equality stuff that we were fighting for.
And so you would do something, they would push back. You would do something else, correct. They would push, and eventually they were like, you've done too much.
Enough's enough. Yeah.
And how old, like, how long ago was this?
This is 2013. So okay. Only 3 years ago.
3 years ago. You're kicked to the curb.
Yeah, or 2 years ago. Yeah, 2.5 years ago.
You're right, it is 2015, but it's almost the end of 2015.
Yeah, I know, I'm already jumping ahead. I'm starting to fill in my calendar for 2016, so it starts to like mess with me. So at that point, I have some decisions to make, and at the beginning, it was really only a religious decision. It wasn't sort of a theological thing about whether God exists. And I thought, well, will I be Adventist? That was a pretty easy question to answer. I thought, no, I think I've outgrown that whole brand. Obviously, I'm not Adventist enough to be a pastor, so I'm moving on.
And you're seeing this Methodist church across the street with a big rainbow flag on it. And,
they're celebrated for the very thing I'm vilified for.
Yeah.
We're doing the same work, and they get a pat on the back, and I get kicked out of the church. You know, so I'm like, well, this is dumb.
Yeah, and look, there are places that I could go.
I could go.
Yeah.
So I start to think in those terms of, you know, maybe I need to be ordained in a different denomination. But then I start to think, that's a lot of work, and I got to go back to school for that, and do I even really want to do that?
Gosh, you've already put so much time into
this. I'm 40 years old by this point. I'm like, I already know how to be a pastor. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can just find... Well, and other people were saying you should plant your own church, which I was interested in that, but I was so exhausted from being a pastor. So there was a psychosocial toll that this all took on me.
And also, like, God, just from a business perspective, starting from scratch.
When religion is in decline and there's so many, especially in Los Angeles, so many very understandable prejudices against religion, you know.
I forget sometimes, you know, it's funny because I can be a little bit flippant about, you know, I'm an atheist and everybody, it's like, I was just talking about this on Skeptics Guide this week, actually, probably hasn't even aired yet, about how, like, sometimes I forget and I just, like, assume everybody is atheist, you know what I mean? But that's a privilege I have living in LA.
Well, and I think in LA what we have a lot of, too, are these spiritual but not religious people.
Oh, God,
people.
They're the word, like the people with the crystals and the...
Right, yeah. So they're not going to agree with you and me about atheism, but they're also not going to come to your church.
No.
Like, to start a church, you've got to find a group of people that's willing to not only show up every weekend, like Saturday or Sunday morning... Like, who gets up at Saturday morning or Sunday morning and pay money?
Yeah, like probably up to 10% of their
income. Up to 10% of their income, and then volunteer on top of that. I mean, that's a tough sell in a community that's like, you know, I just kind of listen to music at home, or I go to this lecture once in a while that feeds me spiritually. Or
yeah, like I have this candle that I sit in front of.
Right. Or I listen to a podcast that feeds me, and I don't need to come to church. Why do I need to come out to your building?
And also, like, I don't, you know, there's some aspects of what you're saying that kind of don't suit my lifestyle.
Right, exactly.
Like a very LA way to be religious.
It's so true. And I had church members that would, they went to a Kabbalah class one night of the week, and then they went to hear Marianne Williamson speak about whatever she talks about, a kind of quasi New Age whatever, and then they would come to church once in a while, and then there's just capitalism, like, people are busy.
Yeah.
They go to work. They travel. They go on vacation. And they're never at church. And you're like, dude, I'm slaving away over here trying to make this community grow. It's just exhausting.
Ugh.
So you end up being essentially an entertainer. I joked with people that I had this, people would say, well, what are you doing this weekend? I'm like, well, I have this stand-up gig I do every weekend. They're like, really? Oh, cool. And I'm like, yeah, it's at this church. But it really was like getting up in front of a group of people and going, come on, guys, isn't this the greatest thing ever?
Like today we're going to talk about guilt.
Right. Exactly.
Like, oh, shit.
Yeah, like, yay, coming out to feel shitty about myself. Awesome. Yes, let's sell that. So
how long did you go just like kind of aimlessly jobless?
9 months. So from March of 2013, when I resigned, to the end of that year. And by the end of that year, I was having Thai noodles with a friend of mine in Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this book called Religion for Atheists that I had just picked up at the Romans bookstore.
Is that, that's not Hemant, is it?
No, this was a or this was called Religion Without God.
Interesting.
Something
but it's
like
similar
that.
To kind of what Hemant
did,
right?
Yeah.
Which is like trying to teach religious people
about
their religion.
Yeah, exactly. So my friend was like, he was a seminary student at the time at Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what are you doing reading that? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm really just reaching for anything now. Like maybe there's no God. I mean, in fact, I sort of suspect there isn't now, you know.
By the way, are you married at this point?
At that point, I was just separated.
Gotcha. And was the religious stuff, or is that a whole different
story? No, it was a different story. Gotcha. I mean, it was...
Which, you know, we don't have to go into it, but
no,
I'm just wondering
fine.
If, like, I can only imagine being a Seventh-day Adventist pastor, and then all of a sudden being like, I'm questioning whether I believe in God, that might be tough on a marriage.
Right, yeah, it is tough. And I think my now ex-wife was also had big questions, too.
I see.
And
so at least there was a little bit of empathy there.
We were both very liberal Adventists by that point, but to say there's not a God, or to sort of even seriously suspect that there's
that
not...
That may be beyond the pale for somebody,
Right. So I launched that Year Without God. I gave about 3 days thought to it, literally.
So, like, it's easy in hindsight to, like, did you write a book about it? You did.
No, I'm working on a book
okay,
now.
But you have written many, like, articles about it.
Right.
And it's definitely, it has a name. It's the Year Without God. It's like, it's branded. And it's easy in hindsight after a year without God to say, this is the thing I did.
Right.
But when you first started it, where you're like, I'm going to go a year without God.
I had these Thai noodles with that guy. And and later that same afternoon, I wrote him an email and said, well, I'm thinking about buying a URL and starting this blog. Because he said, you should blog about it. And I'm like, yeah, I've been a blogger for 10 years off and on. So I was familiar with the form.
But about religious shit.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. I would, and I had a podcast. It was my weekly sermon.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I wrote him an email and I said, well, I'm thinking of two URLs. One is yearwithoutgod.com. The other one is my year as an atheist or something like that. And he's like,
so you already decided I'm going to do this kind of personal experiment.
Right. I had decided that I was going to do it. And I was actually working for a church at the time, not as a pastor, but as a consultant, helping them think about getting their church more involved in the community, doing sort of social service projects.
Okay.
And I wrote a very liberal Adventist church, probably similar to the one I was just fired from. I said to the pastor, look, I'm thinking about doing this. I sent him my opening column that I had written and said, do you think this is going to be a problem? And he's like, no, I think it's good. Like, there's an atheist that comes to church here once in a while with his wife. And
oh, that's cool.
And he's
so
like,
pretty liberal.
It'll be all right, you know? And so I was like, okay, that was my main source of income. So I was like, I don't want to like fuck that up too
bad.
Yeah,
you're like, I'm not going to make that much money off this blog.
Right. So. Or any. I mean, I didn't think it would be. I thought it would be like any other blog I've ever had, which is there's like 10 people that read it.
Well, you can't go into blogging or podcasting, by the way, expecting to make money.
No.
Like, it's icing if it happens, but it's definitely not like, I'm going to get rich podcasting.
It's like even writing books. So there are like 5 people who make a lot of money writing books.
Hitchens was one of them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or novelists, you know, like not everyone's Dan Brown, you know, who's going to write some, you know,
yeah,
not very amazing but also very catchy story.
I guess Dan Brown is the new like Stephen King, isn't he?
Well, and
like
Stephen
I would
King's
never use
one.
That yeah, no, that but reference, he, but you're right.
Yeah, and then he sold the movie rights and yeah. you know, off you go. Yeah.
Or who's the one who does all the like really cheesy like The Notebook and all of those?
Oh, Nicholas Sparks.
Nicholas Sparks. Yeah, he probably
I'm
makes
so
lots
sorry
of money
I know
too.
That. So I just he said definitely go Year Without God. That's way better. Mm-hmm. I'm like, "All right, fine." So
it is good.
Yeah. I bought the URL, but it was sort of that much thought, and then I wrote, and I also have been a writer. I have a blog on Huffington Post, and I thought, well, I haven't written on Huffington Post in probably 3 months, so this will be interesting to the folks at Huffington Post.
And you were probably at that point, which is so funny because I was very close to the religion editor there, weirdly, because I worked there as a science correspondent, Jawid Kaleem. I don't know if you ever worked with him, but you were probably mostly posting in the religion blogs
right,
before that.
Right, I was. And Paul, you know, I don't know if you know Paul Rauschenbusch, who's the religion editor.
Oh, no, I don't.
For Huffington Post.
Gotcha. So, yeah, so maybe Jawid is his partner or something.
Something like
There's
that,
like,
yeah.
It's very confusing there.
So, yeah, I just put it up there. And, you know, I had no... I knew about Hitchens and Dawkins and a little Sam Harris. But that,
so you're pretty liberal that you, like, kind of know their work.
Well, and I read... In fact, I just met Dawkins for the first time the other day. And I brought the book for him to sign. And the book...
God Delusion.
And,
so good.
And I told him, I said, I quoted from your book in one of my sermons once, you know, and because I was the kind of Christian at that point that read his book and was like, yeah, this is true.
Yeah, you're like, this is why we have a bad name.
Yeah, and this is why my church is different.
Gotcha. Exactly. Right? Like I'm not going to be like these people that these atheists have something to say something about.
About, right. And I read God Is Not Great as well and kind of had the same sort of reaction. So I was reading stuff, but I did not know about the podcast universe of atheism and skepticism and free thought. I didn't know.
And all these conferences, the community aspect.
I mean, if you go back and read that original blog post, I said, if there are atheist gatherings, I'd like to attend a couple. I mean, it was like if. Like, yeah. I didn't know... that there was CFI. I didn't know that there was, you know, all of these organizations.
And what I love is that that is such an analogy. It's such a common experience for almost anybody who leaves their faith, is that it's almost like opening your eyes for the first time that there's a world outside of the world
right.
you're in. So almost everybody has this experience of, and I did too, of this like, I'm the only one.
Right.
And then you start to slowly realize that there are like-minded people, especially now that we live in the internet age. We're so blessed by that.
Right.
Blessed. But you start slowly experience or realize that there are a lot of other people in your same position.
Right.
And that helps to, I think, reinforce that you're not, you know, evil.
Right. And I think there are these kind of very negative stereotypes. And I wasn't the kind of sheltered Christian either. I was very involved in interfaith work. I had good friends who were Muslim and Jewish and Sikh and, you know, Hindu. And so I was, what's weird about that is I was in all these interfaith coalitions, about three of them. And I, you know, we shared our religious traditions with one another. We sort of honored each other's religious traditions in a very generous sort of way. But I still didn't know any atheists.
And that's the funny thing, because it's, you say that there is this like stigma, and it's so true. Even you can tell in the title selection of the blog, Year Without God is less offensive immediately
right.
than My Year as an Atheist, because right. it almost implies for a lot of people that much more of a commitment
right.
or a rejection. I think a lot of people see it that way, whereas I personally think that anybody who is not a theist is an atheist. It's just
right.
it's a lack of theism. But a lot of people don't look at it that way.
Right.
And they would rather, like, there are plenty of people who would say, oh, I don't believe in God. And then you'd be like, well, you're an atheist. No, I'm not fucking atheist.
I had a JPL scientist. I drive for Lyft now. This is my new career. And I had a JPL scientist in my car the other day.
Uh-huh. Oh, and, fascinating. Oh, yeah, because you're in Pasadena.
I'm in Pasadena.
So you have all these, like, really smarty pants people in your car.
Right.
I love
it. Well, I was
it.
Driving him to his home near here, and he was coming from work or whatever, and you know, Lyft is known for being super chatty. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we're our...
Oh, God,
we're
do you have to fist bump?
We're the... No, we don't fist bump, I don't think.
I think Lyft used to fist bump.
Yeah, they've gotten less corny. They used to have that fuzzy pink mustache,
but now
too.
Don't you have like a light...
The glowy one.
The glowy one. Yeah.
Only after you've given 100 rides, though. They're not doling those out to just anybody.
Gotcha.
So, you know, but it is fun. I do end up talking, and I'm a very outgoing person, so I do end up talking to people, and... I'm like, oh, wow, you work at JPL. That's cool. What do you do? And he's like, well, I'm actually a climate scientist. And mm-hmm. everybody thinks I'm a rocket scientist, but I'm not. And I'm like, well, that's great. What do you do? Of course, I told him, I write and I do a podcast. And we got to talking about that. He's like, yeah, well, that's cool. He's like, I don't, you know, I'm not an, I wouldn't call myself an atheist. He's like, I don't believe in God. You know, I'm, his direct quote was, I'm a scientist, so there's no fucking way. But I'm not an atheist.
I love it. It's so true because it's like, it's the label has so much stigma attached that it almost has nothing to do with the truth of what the word means. It just has to do with like, don't put me in that bucket.
Well, and his follow-up comment was, I just don't care enough.
Oh, so he's an apatheist. Some of them call themselves that.
Well,
which
he doesn't
is kind of
believe
funny.
In God, so he's an atheist, but he's not going to go, he's the kind, and there are thousands and thousands of people like this. They're not going to go to Apostacon or Skepticon or even TAM. Like they're just not. If they're going to go to a convention, they're going to go to a very specific, like
he's
in his
be
case,
going to a climate science
convention with him and his colleagues.
Because the truth is, I do think that a lot of the people who go to these kind of conferences are one step beyond. They're atheists, but they're probably also atheist activists.
Right.
Whereas there are people who are just atheists. But sadly, it's like the word has so much garbage attached to it that a lot of people are either scared to or like not willing to admit that that label actually applies to them because they, you know, I grew up and I learned that being an atheist was like horrible. So why would I want to be an atheist? I think that sticks in your mind.
And what I'm doing now, if I may, is called Life After God. And so my podcast is called Life After God. And it's more than the podcast because we are trying to work with people. Not like my climate scientist passenger, but more people who are freshly leaving their faith or questioning their faith. And
it's a hard adjustment.
It's a hard adjustment, especially people's whole social world is built around those beliefs and relationships. And if it was simply, as some people think, a matter of just taking those ideas out of your brain and tossing them in the trash, that would be one thing. But those ideas are woven into your family relationships, your friendships,
social structure.
Everything. Yeah. And people are really in some difficult places. And so we do one-on-one coaching with people just over the phone or Skype, just talking through issues, helping them think through parenting issues, marriage issues, career choices, you know, just how to deal with this transition.
So this is really a way for you to use the skills that you developed and kind of focus throughout your career as a minister to basically do more atheist ministry.
Yeah, I was just talking to someone on the phone the other day from Secular Student Alliance, and I said, you know, if you'll permit me the use of the word ministry, it's kind of like ministry. And she's like, oh no, I'm totally comfortable with that word. Like, I think, you know, until we have a better word, that's what we're doing.
Because it's more like the fellowship component than it is like the evangelical, I want to convert you component.
Correct.
It's like these are people who have already made that decision and you're just there to make sure that they're not falling into, you know, some of the struggles that come along with the mental illness that comes after. You know, if you are, I deal with this a lot. You know, I talk about mental illness a lot on the podcast. If you're somebody like myself who is prone to depressive episodes, this is a massive trigger for them.
Right.
And then you've lost your social support and you've got, you know, and it can very easily spiral for people because there's a lot of baggage.
Right.
That
and
you have
we've
to work
been
through.
Taught as Christians that we are bad people bound for hell if we don't accept Jesus as our savior.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, and I wrote about this during Year Without God, like you can have a person like, to pick the most evil person in the whole wide world, you could have a person like Hitler who on his deathbed accepts Jesus and goes to heaven, and a person like, I don't know, your grandmother, who's the sweetest person in the whole world, who just didn't believe in God, and she's going to hell.
It's like that, if you've ever seen that Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flames play. That's exactly what it is. It's a, I can't remember if it's like method. But it is one of these like faith-based things. And yeah, it's like a bus driver driving a bus of children, and he gets in a wreck, and he like loves the children. He's always taking care of them, but he doesn't, he's got questions, and so he goes to hell. And you've got like a child molester who like right before he dies is like, accept
me. Forgive me.
Yeah, it's so bullshit. Whereas like that is a big difference with the Mormon faith. The Mormon faith is a works-based religion. Mm. And they're like, you can't just fucking say that shit right before you die and expect to get. It's like, no, that's why they have the three tiers of heaven and you've got all these ordinances you have to
and
have.
And the Catholics
to get to
are
them.
Like that too. They have
exactly.
Tiers.
It's like, yeah, fuck you. Like, you got to earn it
throughout
your life.
You're going to have to show some evidence.
But regardless, whether it's works-based, faith-based, or some combination of the two, the one thing that is pretty prominent in almost every Christian denomination is that if you accept the Lord and then you reject him later, you're the worst of the worst.
You are totally fucked.
Yeah, this is the worst thing you can do, according to most of these people, is actually, it's one thing if you never had
Right.
If you never got baptized, if you never, but if like us,
right,
you committed yourself and then you were like, eh, I changed my mind.
Right.
Then you're like, you got to deal with the guilt. There's a weird guilt that comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. The easiest way to deal with it is to meet other people who are in your same position and talk to them.
And it is scary because I think in the back of my mind, even as I was still a Christian, but becoming gradually more liberal, there was this thing in the back of my mind thinking, well, what if I'm wrong? I could be wrong. And because I'm naturally a kind of person who thinks I could be wrong, which I think is actually a healthy frame of mind.
It means you're a skeptic.
Right, exactly.
And you're a scientific thinker.
Yeah. So, if your world is built around the one thing you cannot be wrong about.
Yes.
And then you think you might be wrong, that's a terrible place to be.
This is also why I think a lot of people are a bit scared of the term atheist and agnostic.
Right.
Which to me is like the same
hedging
fucking thing.
Bets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I think there is that in, but I could be wrong.
Right.
And that's where I think it's a lack of understanding of the terminology.
Correct.
Because
it's
a scientific focus of your life. Like you are thinking scientifically if you are always saying I could be wrong, which is why you never say with 100% certainty, this is what I believe.
Right.
And I always make the distinction. Some people don't think it's that important, but when I say I'm an atheist, it's because I have a lack of belief. It's not because I believe there is no God.
Right.
I simply don't believe
right.
there is a God.
Yeah. I just did an interview that's the current episode on my podcast with a guy who really, you know, grew up pretty religious, but isn't religious anymore. He's an atheist now. And, you know, the poll quote that I pulled out of that for the opening part of that podcast, he says, you know, I would love to believe that there is a God. You know, if it's a great story, he's a writer, he's mm-hmm. a fiction writer. He's like, it's a great story. I wish it were true.
Yeah.
And if it were true, you know, if I had some kind of inclination that it was true, I would believe in God right now, but I just don't, you know? And I think sometimes there's that pushback from people that I get that's, you just didn't want to believe, or you decided you just wanted to like be rebellious or something. And I was like, no, the year without God, really my posture during year without God was A, I suspected there probably wasn't a God after all this, but B, I really wanted there to be. And I wanted to take a year and try to see like, is my suspicion just a bad case of depression or nihilism, or is there, you know, and is there a reason to believe in God? Or if there's not, then I'm moving on.
And also, I would think that for somebody who is so trained in ministry, that this is the truest test of your faith, right? Mm-hmm. If I can not pray on a daily basis, if I can get away from all of the rites and rituals and just live my life as if,
right.
then if I come around at the end of it and my faith is reinforced, then it's like there's kind of no other question.
Yeah, this is why I'm a little surprised by people of faith who don't want to talk about the question.
Yeah, because it's like, are you that weakly tied
right.
to your faith that you're afraid that like, or any of it, you know, it's a similar mindset to people who don't want to legalize gay marriage because they're like, well, once it's legal, then like all the straight people are going to want to be like fucking people. It's like, really? Is that how you think? like you're just going to have this rash of people like switching sides.
And even if they did, that's the other thing. Like even if all of a sudden, you know, straight people were like, hey, maybe it's not so bad. I should try. Like, so what?
Exactly. But I love it. It's the people who are the most like, oh, we can't allow that. That would be bad. There would just be like mass gayness.
Well, or the next thing is like, next thing you know, people are going to want to have sex with their dog.
Oh my God, I know.
You know, or marry their parakeet or something.
And you're like, listen, there's always been a very small percentage of the population that does that, and it's not okay.
Yeah,
we all know that that's not the same thing, and it's really insulting
yeah.
to human beings who want to have sex with each other.
Right, right. And it's, you know, evolution just doesn't select for people who do that.
Exactly.
It's not good. It's not
yeah,
good.
But you can't use the E word with these people. Come
right,
on.
Either.
So now you're on the other side of it. Now you've moved on from a year without God into
life after God.
Life after God. And you're working in an outreach capacity to have support groups for people to answer phones and have these kinds of conversations. But as I was introduced to you through David Smalley from Dogma Debate, you also still, because you were ordained and now you've been reordained in the Church of Bacon.
And I'm also seeking the American Humanist Association's
That's great. Yeah, yeah.
Certification.
Which means that you could actually, that one I think people see as being more legitimate. So if you went
right.
like into armed service or something like
I
that.
I know, when I tell people that I'm ordained in the Church of Bacon, they all laugh and I'm like, no, it's really a thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. is Pastafarianism not a real thing?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if you can like legitimately have.
I don't really care.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's a weird legal thing that you have to. And the truth is, you know how to officiate a service.
Right.
You've been doing it for decades.
And more importantly, like, I know how to be with people that are going through various situations,
yeah,
whether
life
it's grief
experiences.
Or joy.
Exactly. So you have officiated plenty, I'm sure, of weddings and funerals when you were a pastor in
sure.
the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now that you're on the other side of it, now you can offer a humanist perspective, which we're so lacking. So the reason I know you is because a dear friend of mine lost a family member recently, a younger sister. And there was a lot of struggle, as he told me, before they finally figured out how to sort of honor the wishes of the parents who were Jewish, but also honor the wishes of his sister who he lost, who is a non-believer. And ultimately, the family said, okay, let's not have a religious ceremony or some sort of a hybrid ceremony.
It ended up being a hybrid.
Yeah. And he reached out to me and he said, you know, and he was obviously not in a good way. Mm. And he's like, this is what's happening. Do you know anyone?
Right.
And I, of course, because he's like, I think if anybody knows anyone, you'd probably know someone. And I immediately go to David because David is so connected in the community.
Right. He really is.
And he's like, yeah, I know lots of people. And he starts going down the list and listing these different people. And when he mentioned you, I thought that you sounded so wonderful. And so we finally made that connection. So I of course, I wasn't there. I wasn't close to his sister. I was only close to him. And I thought it might be disingenuous to get in the way. I never want to be that person. But I heard it was absolutely beautiful.
It was.
Incredibly sad.
It's maybe, even after 19 years of pastoral mm-hmm. ministry, one of the two or three most difficult funerals I've ever been a part of.
And it's hard when you lose the young one. You know what
right.
I mean? You lose somebody who's young, you lose
so
somebody
much promise.
To illness and, you know, or injury. And that can be very difficult. But what a wonderful thing that we're seeing more and more commonly, either religious family members or people who aren't that religious, understanding that you don't have to have a religious service just because traditionally that's what most people do.
Right.
You can in many ways, oh, killer saying hi, I love it.
Yes.
You can in many ways honor somebody's faith or lack of faith. And there are people out there who can officiate and who can talk about the beauty of life without having to mention God every 5 seconds,
right.
Which to me is so, I don't think I'm ever going to get married. I'm not sure how I feel about marriage as an institution, but if I did, fuck yeah, I'd have an atheist ceremony.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And how cool that that's an option and you don't have to go to the courthouse for it.
Well, one of the cool things that happened to me last year too was that a pastor friend of mine mm-hmm. called me up. And he's like, hey, you know, I know you're not a pastor anymore, but can you still do weddings? And I'm like, yeah, I can.
Like,
he's like, well, I have this.
I do
this,
weddings. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
I know. I got a little chapel over here. I'm converting my second bedroom. No. But he said, well, I have this member in my church whose kids aren't hurt. His, you know, the kid is not religious.
Mm-hmm.
And she's getting married. And he's not religious either. Would you be interested? And I'm like, absolutely.
So that was kind of your first taste of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, I had a wedding already on the calendar when I started Year Without God,
mm-hmm.
and they were or are still spiritual, you know, people. So we had very interesting conversation about how would we do this wedding, so that it was meeting their needs, but also true to who I felt I was trying to be.
Sure,
and we worked that out. It was really cool.
Because there's a way, I think, to honor people's faith without having to lie and bend and say that you're that way too. We just had this conversation on SGU based on a listener email about how, like, it's not nice when somebody loses a loved one to make comments about how, well, they're with God now, they're watching over you, if the person that you're talking to is a non-believer.
Doesn't believe that.
Like, you have to. It's perfectly fine. So say that I, as an atheist, lost somebody close to me. If people were to come up to me and say, well, at least you know they're watching over you, not only would I be like, no, they're fucking not, I would be offended by that. But
right.
if somebody said, I'm praying for you and your family, that's different.
Right.
I appreciate that. That's them looking into their own faith and making decisions that they want to make for me.
Right.
You know, and I think those are two very different things.
And we all have that impulse where we know, like, well, your friend who just lost his sister,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have this feeling like, gosh, I wish there was something I could do. But practically speaking, you know, there really isn't anything you can't bring the person back.
And there are still things you can say that don't have religious influence, you know, like if somebody was in pain and now they're no longer in pain, at least they're not in pain anymore.
Right.
Like these kinds of things that are meaningful,
right.
but they don't have to always evoke God.
Right.
Because at a certain point, that it's like you're walking up to somebody going, wah, 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 wah. And right. It's like, oh, thank you so much for your condolences.
Well, I think all anyone really has to do is to think about, if you're a Christian, if a Muslim came up to you and said, you know, well, you know, I'm sure, you know, the Prophet Muhammad will bless this person in the afterlife. And you're like,
what the fuck?
Why would you say that to me?
And that's exactly what Steve used as the example, is like, can you imagine going up to a Jew and being like, well, Jesus is with him now?
I know.
What the fuck?
No, yeah, that's even more offensive, yeah. You know, just because of the history of what Christians have done to Jews. But like, yeah, it's like that. It's like, why would you say that?
Exactly. And it's like, you don't have to look at it the way, I know some people have a hard time wrapping their head around atheism and a lack of faith, because they're like, oh, you just see everybody as worm food, and you're just right. Like this hard, and it's like, that doesn't mean you have to say shit like that. Like, you right. can say things that are really, really sweet and really, and you can say, I'm praying for you. That right. doesn't offend me.
Right.
If you want to pray for me because you're faithful, that's a very kind thing you're doing for me.
Right.
But don't tell me that Grams is like, playing dice with Jesus. Like, it's not happening. And it kind of offends me.
Yeah, it's fine if you think Graham's playing yeah. dice with Jesus. But
don't try to comfort me by reminding me that that's what's happening. Because then all of a sudden, you're disrespecting, like, the basis of how I structure my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's rough. And also, especially think about the needs of the person who passed. We all know that funerals are for the living.
Right.
You know, especially atheists, we know that when somebody passes on, there's no more conscious awareness, and it's really for the family, which is why I think what a beautiful idea to have this sort of hybrid ceremony.
Right.
Because the parents are mourning and the parents are Jewish. But, you know, the siblings are mourning, and the friends and family and loved ones of this person who did not believe are also mourning, and they are non-believers. Let's respect all of their faiths
right.
and make sure that everybody can walk away saying, that was a beautiful ceremony, and now I have closure, which is really, I think, what it's about.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think people are, even those in attendance are all in different places too. I mean, I was always keenly aware when I was a pastor that not everyone in attendance at the funeral sees the world the same way either, yeah. you know? So people, and honestly, if you stop people on the street and ask them, you know, point blank, like, what do you think about what happens after you die? Like, most people don't know.
Yeah.
They might be Christian, but they might be like, well, you know, when push comes to shove, who the hell knows?
And like, how arrogant to think that you're the arbiter of truth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, to be in a position where you're emotionally just stripped, and you're just, all your you know, your feels are on the table, and then there's somebody up there trying to tell you this is how it is.
I remember in the very beginning of my ministry, I did a funeral, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, how come you didn't mention hell or anything about that in the funeral? And
why
I was like,
fuck would you talk about hell in a funeral?
His point was like, why didn't you tell people that they have to believe if they want to see this person again? You know, and that
and
happens.
Like, that's rough, fool. Like,
people do that. They're like,
so
you know,
fucked
and
up.
All of you who are still here today, you know, if you want to see Aunt Mary again someday, you better believe in Jesus, and then you'll go to heaven and you'll be able to spend eternity with your loved
one. So these
people
who are already so depressed and mourning are now getting piled on, like, and
right.
by the way, I know you feel like shit now. I'm going to take you to an even rougher place.
So like, when I said to that guy, I was like, I just don't think that that's, like, appropriate, and I don't really believe in hell like that anyway. And he was like, well, how do you encourage people to believe in God if there's no hell? Like, it was just inconceivable to him that unless there was this big stick hanging over you.
Oh my God.
That I'm like, well, is that really why you believe? You think that you're going to burn forever? I mean, the sad truth is a lot of people do.
And I wonder if you really took them to the side and you were able to look them in the eye and get through to them and say, why don't you just try for a while about maybe assuming that hell doesn't exist and see how that affects
you. See how that feels.
Yeah, see how it feels, because maybe your faith is strengthened,
right.
which is wonderful, but maybe you find a new joy in your faith.
Well,
that
and
didn't
that's actually
before.
What I was trying to do with, you know, some people criticize Year Without God by saying, like, you can't just try on atheism, but it was exactly that. It was like, well, let's just try and think about the world if there's no God, and how
I
does that look?
You can
look?
Try on atheism. Why would people say that? Because most atheists tried on religion for a while.
Right.
It happens, but it is rare that somebody's like, oh, I was just raised secular.
Right.
I don't know.
More and more that's happening, but right.
Yeah.
Our age and older, mm-hmm. you know, people were mostly raised in religion. I think people said it because it's not like, not believing in God is not something you just wake up one day and just go, I think I don't believe in God. Like, you either believe in it or you don't
yeah.
believe in it. You can't fake it. But that's you can true. Kind of fake it. I mean, that's my point was you go to a science fiction movie mm-hmm. and you suspend your disbelief long enough to get through the movie. We all know there are no orcs and wizards and, you know, whatever.
And most of us atheists can think back to a time when we were fully doing that in church. In when church. We were like, yeah.
Right.
And there are people who are actively religious right now who are struggling with those feelings.
Right,
and
around so, Easter time when exactly. you're like, I've never seen anybody raised from the dead, but I guess maybe Jesus was raised from the dead.
And maybe he was eating chocolate eggs. I'm confused.
I'm confused. Why did he do these things? What?
No, but yeah, I mean, and so maybe trying that out is not the worst idea. And of course, it's personal for everybody. And I do appreciate having these kinds of conversations with you, Ryan, because I also, being an atheist and being a skeptic and being an activist and surrounding myself with very hard-lined people in my life, people I respect so much, but the Dawkins of the world, the Sean Carrolls of the world, sometimes you do have a loss of that middle ground and mm-hmm. of that not necessarily of that respect, but it doesn't always come through.
Right.
You know what I mean? Sometimes it comes across as disrespectful or dismissive. And so I do really enjoy having conversations with people who, even though they're atheists, are still humanists.
Right.
And still try to empathize with where everybody is in their life and understand that in some cases, some people have figured out how to have it both ways and they're happy.
Right.
And so long as they aren't, you know, trying to teach children in school that, you know, XY doesn't exist or trying to undermine scientific progress, what's the harm?
Right.
And I think that that's an important question that we should all be asking ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we all believe stories that may or may not be true. Like if you work hard, you'll make a good living and buy a house. When, I mean, that's yeah. a story that we believe that a lot of people, it comes true for them, and other people, it doesn't come true for them. And
yeah, and a lot of people, I mean, and I think the definition of being a skeptic is that you're always trying to bust through those shackles that, you know.
That's right.
Well, let's look at the data. We don't have good social mobility or economic mobility in this country, so maybe that's not quite true, and I'm going to start to rethink the way I think about those things. And that's great, and I think we should all strive to be strong skeptics, but the truth of the matter is we're not all always going to be skeptics, mm-hmm. and because somebody's not a skeptic doesn't make them less human. It doesn't make them less intelligent.
That's
and it
right.
doesn't make them less deserving of our respect and our understanding and our empathy, and I think that we sometimes forget that in this community.
And, I agree.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that.
I think just
that.
Even a little hospitality would go a long way. You know, just when someone comes along and says, I'm having these deep doubts about my faith. I still believe in God, and I still believe in an afterlife, but I don't know if I believe in blah, blah, blah. And it seems like, at least on the internets, mm-hmm. you know, the atheist community can be so hard on people like that. Like, wow, you once you grow up and
yeah.
and have a rational thought, you know, you'll realize that you're just, you know, been duped. And it's like, well, never mind. I'm going to go back over here with.
Yeah, it's like, that's not helpful. And also, like, this is often the same person who's like, why don't you respect the fact that I'm not Christian and stop
right,
praying in
right,
public?
Right,
and
right,
like,
right.
Double standard.
Double standard, yeah.
So anyway, we are running so late, and I know you have to go pick up the chillins.
Yeah.
So before we go, though, I have to ask you the final two questions. I close my podcast the same way with everyone, and I ask them two questions. Really big picture questions, so I'm putting you on the spot.
Oh, wow.
But I'm always interested in hearing people's perspectives. So the first one is, in whatever context that seems apropos, so whether we're talking personal or global, big picture, small picture, what is the thing that keeps you up most at night? What are you most concerned about when you look to the future? And on the flip side of that, we'll end on a positive note and say, what are you most optimistic about, most looking forward to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think both good questions. I think, and something I think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I think I'm most concerned about long-term is probably the state of our climate
mm-hmm.
And the way that we perhaps have irretrievably damaged the biosphere and what that's going to mean for future generations. I think it's easy not to feel the immediate impact of that because I'll be dead before all that starts to fall apart. But we start to see the impact of it even now.
And we separate ourselves from it a bit. You're not separated much because if you look directly to your left, you'll see National Geographic's newest issue.
That's right.
Is on climate.
It is on climate. And I think we're, you know, people are starting to wake up to it. Even
yeah.
though we still see a lot of climate change resistance and denial, people are starting to wake up to it. And it's thanks to people like you and others like, you know, Bill Nye and others who are just out there in the media just saying, come on, guys, wake up. You know, the data is in. short term, I'm concerned, especially as an American, about the state of our democracy. I'm very concerned that we have lost a public space for discourse on difficult issues, and to even just to pick the same issue of climate change, or to pick something like guns, you know. Mm-hmm. I know people have very strong opinions and they marshal the evidence to support their opinions. Whether you, on whatever side or whatever gradation of that issue that you're in, we should be able to have a clear-headed, calm dialogue about the role of firearms, not in, you know, 18th century America, but in 21st century America. What is the role? What's rational? What makes sense? We're not all going to agree, but we should be able to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, a civil human being should be able to have civil debate, and they should be able to, we should be able to say, it's okay to look at nuance.
Right.
You don't have to be so black and white in your decision making.
And to bring like rational, try to, I think, modulate as human beings. And, you know, I work on this and I know you do, between our emotions and our intellect, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to say, well, I feel this way about it. And that's not pointless. My feelings are important, but there's also this evidence which contradicts my feelings. I should be able to, maybe not immediately, but over a reasonable amount of time, think about my ideas and change them, change my mind. And I just don't know that we have a political discourse in this country that is prone to change anyone's mind.
Oh, no. The minute that a politician changes their mind on something, they're vilified as a flip-flopper. They're not celebrated as somebody who evolved in their political stance. And so that right there, I think, is the core of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. We have to be okay with leaders who learn and grow.
Yeah.
And that in many ways will affect us, which we're not okay with.
The thing I'm most optimistic about, I think, is, and maybe every generation says this, but I'm optimistic about the younger generation coming up, that they're, without even thinking about it, mm-hmm. less homophobic, more prone to accept the scientific method, more open and accepting of cultural diversity. They're more exposed to cultural diversity. Even my generation, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. You know, I grew up my first 6 or 7 years in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio. And I could go months, years without seeing someone so different than me. Although Cleveland is a very racially diverse city, I was in a very white suburb. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could go a long time before you met someone that was different than you. My kids, who are 15 and 12, they from day one went to school with kids that had two moms, mm-hmm. or two dads, or one mom or one dad, or no parents that live. You know, they went to school with people who are so different from every country, almost literally in the world.
Yeah, immigrants, you know, people with different religions, people with different just worldviews.
That can't help but create, to my first point, a better democratic space. It's going to be hard, though. It's not easy, because the more you pile those different people together, we see it here in LA, like the more you pile all these diverse people into one relatively small space, conflict happens as well. So I don't think we're out of the woods, and I don't think it's an excuse to be naive, but I think about my kids and what they're learning, the things that I didn't learn until I was so much older. Mm-hmm. Even when it comes to like math and science, like I help my daughter with some stuff that she's doing in school, and I have to like go on the internet and brush up on, like, I was doing that in high school and she's doing it in elementary school.
They're very advanced, and they're digital natives, which really helps. And also, think about the like what they're capable of and what they actually do in some classrooms. Can you imagine if when you were in third grade, your teacher could just pull up a classroom in the Sudan or something like that and be like, hi, kids, wave to the other kids and talk about what your day was like.
Unbelievable.
Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I remember having pen pals, and you would physically hand write a letter and hope that you got one back in like a month or two.
Right.
And that was the way to try and have a global connection
with
somebody.
I collected stamps that
way. Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is oh man, I lost my train of thought.
Well, shit, and it's all my fault.
Yeah, that's okay. We're probably out of time anyway.
Well, I mean, I've got time, but you don't. Actually, I don't have much either, because you've got to go pick up your kids and I have to go to a meeting in Burbank. Oh my God. So I really, oh my gosh, I so enjoyed this conversation. It was so much fun. I feel like I learned a whole lot. I feel like I made a friend.
Yay.
And I'm very excited about that. I do want to thank you for the service that that you provided to my very dear friend in officiating. I'm glad because I know it really meant a lot, and I heard some very good things. So thank you, Ryan, for joining me.
My pleasure.
And thank you everyone else for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.